This is CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday morning. I've been following this man on Twitter for a long time, and I used to read all of his stuff in the Business Day when he was editor there. He was appointed in 2014, and he led the Business Day to a point of credibility and massive influence in South African society. He was also at the Financial Mail as senior associate editor from 2013. He has authored opinion articles for various national publications on politics, the political economy, and ethics. Raising the Bar, Hope and Renewal in South Africa. His first book was published in 2015. He's currently working on his second book, and I'm delighted that he could come and spend some time with us this morning. He is none other than Songe Zozibi. It's a pleasure, sir, to see you. Nice to see you. Now, Songe, you've been very busy, and just so that everybody knows, you're not even involved necessarily in publications anymore of any kind. You're at the Barclays Africa Group as head of communications. Yeah. But you are writing a second book, huh?
I am, yes, I am.
How's that going?
Well, I've kind of had to do the same thing I did with the first one, which is to start it from scratch again after having written.
Did you write it and then things changed so much that you had to throw it out, or was it because you weren't happy?
No, you know, in the last year things changed so much. Jeez. That the assumptions that I had when I started just didn't work anymore. In fact, I had a chat with my publisher, Penn Macmillan, this week, and I sent them a new outline.
I mean, this whole thing that's going on, it starts on the 15th. So what, on Friday? Thursday, we've got the ANC elective conference happening, and nobody, I can find not a person who will nail their colors to the mast on what they think is going to happen, because not even people in the ANC know what's going to happen.
Yeah, nobody. The thing is, nobody knows how much money is on offer.
Well, that's it. Didn't Fikile Mbalula said yesterday that they'd intercepted 2.5 million rand that was going in some direction for nefarious vote buying or whatever it was.
And he posted a fake picture, though.
Yeah, well, there's always, you know, at least it wasn't a Gupta bot. Otherwise, we would have known it was fake from the beginning. There's that, and then there's all this commentary coming from Jackson Mthembu about how people are trying to rig it in this side, and he's obviously in a certain faction. Who knows what's going on there? It sounds like chaos.
What I do know is that people have been offered all sorts of inducements to, you know, to vote one way or the other. I know quite a few people, some of whom are delegates, and people have been offered everything from money to, at least that's what they tell me. And these are people, you know, there's a couple of people who are actual delegates who've been selected, who've been told me they've been offered all sorts of inducements to vote in the right way, I guess, depending on who's offering.
You know, Pumi Mashiko and Muzi Kuzwayo, who work here with us, have put together a documentary, a couple of short pieces on what is going on at branch level.
Yeah.
In particular in KZN, where obviously a lot of people are most attentive to what the movements up and down and left and right are, because that's where the contestation will take place.
Yeah.
Now, they've put together this documentary. They asked old members of the ANC, these are struggle stalwarts, veterans, you know, what do you think's going on? Some of these people are going to the conference as delegates. I heard a terrifying thing. Apparently 800 members were suspended by Zweli Mkhize in KZN.
Why?
Because clearly they weren't the right people to go and vote. And this is not an outrage. People are not seemingly very upset about this. How could this be? 800 people are suspended from your organization. That's insane, right? Means the organization's rotten.
Yeah, look, I mean,
you would think.
No, look, I mean, I think the biggest issue in this conference is going to be credentials, because it's going to be exceptionally difficult to discern who's a genuine delegate and who's not. And even among those 800, it's possible that a lot of them shouldn't have been going anyway. And because you just don't know, like you said, you don't know who's a genuine article and who's not. And that's a difficulty for the ANC, a big one.
Well, I'm sorry to have hopped straight into that, but that is the news of the week.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, there's lots that I want to talk to you about your career, where you were before this, what you've done so far, and all the things that you've achieved. You're very vocal these days on Twitter, and you retweet a lot of very interesting things. So I'm curious as to who you use as your sources. I mean, who are the people that you're interested in following? Who do you get really pertinent, valuable information from? Because you seem to me to be a source that I'm relying on a lot of the time, for what I know.
Look, I think a lot of the people that I was speaking to when I was an editor and when I was a writer, they're still available to me. So they still tell me stuff virtually on a daily basis. Or we talk about stuff, let me put it like that. We talk about things almost on a daily basis. And so you stay plugged in into what's going on.
I mean, I would aver almost that you are as influential, if not more influential, post the Business Day than you were while you were at the Business Day. Because although you're not the editor of that publication, which is a great publication, you still have all the followers on social media who rely on you. And perhaps that's even grown in leaps and bounds since you left the Business Day. And you're freer. You're able to do a lot more. You're able to say a lot more. You don't have a board that you have to report to. You don't have to run stories by your colleagues, you know, that kind of thing. Do you feel that way?
No, it's kind of the opposite. I mean, when I was at the paper, I there were certain restrictions, because sometimes it wasn't so much the board, as it were, or management. It was more having to be careful around my subjective comment on stories that were ongoing, that we're still working on, because you don't want people to say you prejudge the issue. So I had to watch what I was saying. But that was limited to things that we were actually working on or where I didn't have the full certainty. At the same time, it was a lot freer, I have to say. Where I am, there are things which are difficult to comment on because there are relationships. So I never tweet about the finance minister because I work for a bank, right? If I wasn't, I really would have tweeted a lot. And there are also sometimes instances where the party that's in the news is a client and we're involved. It's just that people don't know.
Right.
That we
and
are.
Then you have to be careful.
So I have to be careful what I'm saying. But it's not difficult for me because at the paper I was having to do the same anyway. And in some instances it was in the interest of a source because I couldn't say something because if I do, people might figure out who told me. and I put that person
and
in
you prejudice them.
So it's the same level of care, I guess, and also just not being terrible to people or vulgar or anything.
But Songyazo, this is something that I've always admired about you, is you've maintained an ability to pull the pertinent, credible facts out of a story, but also occasionally to give just the right amount of opinion. You seem to me to be one of the most considered people when it comes to this. And on social media, it's hard. It's very difficult. How do you remind yourself sometimes when to put the brake and when to put the accelerator down? Because it seems to be a unique gift in your case. Other people I find are, you know, even the people I like Ranjeni, she'll sometimes get very emotional about a story. She'll sometimes tweet something which is quite inflammatory. She'll reply to trolls, for example. I somehow seem with you to never have to encounter anything that is patently
that's reckless, maybe.
Reckless. That's a good word.
Yeah. No, thanks, Gareth. I mean, it's something I've learned. I don't know if it's a gift. It's something that I've had to learn, particularly when I was at the paper. You just had to be so careful because I needed to protect the integrity of the paper and my colleagues in particular, because journalists, as you know, put their names behind the story. Mm. And so you've got the title and this credibility, you've got the journalist and their credibility. And we rely on one another's skill and networks and credibility to sustain the credibility of the whole thing. So you have to be very considered in what you say, because you could cast your colleagues in a bad light inadvertently. The second thing is to only ever tweet about sports when you've been drinking. So so if you see me tweeting about Kaizer Chiefs or Arsenal,
you know,
or Liverpool, then you know I'm having a glass or two. I'll stay away from, because it's, you know, it's generally a safe space to talk about. The last thing, Gareth, though, is that I really like to consider things anyway. I don't mind reading. I read a hell of a lot. So what I'll typically do is I'll take my time and read a judgment or something,
right,
and go through it and really think about it, and sometimes refer to other sources, and then form a view. And by the time you do that, the heat of the moment has passed, and you can tweet dispassionately rather than, you know, get angry and
timing is really important, huh?
Timing's important. For me, I typically developed a habit of not getting in when everybody's worked up about something. So I'll leave it for a while.
That's
and
so
then
clever.
And then I'll think about it. I'll look at what everybody's saying and then I'll start looking for info and then I'll offer an opinion.
So is it too early to get an opinion from you on this whole Steinhoff saga? Because this is the big business story of the last 2 weeks in South Africa. I mean, it's just such a mess.
It is a bit early, but at the same time it's not. And I was chatting to a friend of mine over the last 2 days, and I said, look, the first publication to really look forward to is the Financial Mail this week. And of course I've got a cover. That's partly because I know how things work, but also how difficult it is to write a comprehensive story about something like this, because you have to find sources, you have to find people who are willing to talk, you have to develop an understanding of the context. Sometimes you read hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents and other references before you can form a view. Now, social media has this instant gratification thing that it has, that you have to offer an opinion now,
straight away.
You have to make a decision straight away. You just can't work like that. And I've found myself in a situation like that before with Alistair Sparks. And I decided then that what I was going to do was to say, I will take my time to make a decision. Until then, I'm not going to say anything. And that's all I offered. So on Steinhoff, it's a good idea to understand what really happened. And I think, and I haven't read the Financial Mail, I can see they have a cover. That's really the first time that a lot of us are going to start getting an understanding of what happened. All we know is that it's bad because the chief executive resigned. Beyond that, we don't quite understand.
I mean, this is a company that everybody would hold up as some kind of South African success story, that it spread into Europe, that it became this massive retailer of home goods.
Yeah.
second biggest in Europe, I think. Marcus Uster was regarded as this golden boy who just, he did everything right and he was so smart, and Christo Wiese loved him and he was handling so much of the business. And then we find out, and he had all these horse, these racehorses and all this very interesting, he wasn't a very public person, but he had this very interesting life and obviously lots and lots of money. And then we see this is going on behind the scenes, that effectively what they're doing is, they're creating a false idea of what's really happening in the company to push up the share price.
That happens a lot. I've worked for listed companies before, and for about a decade, I kind of worked with investor relations. I wasn't the investor relations person, but from a communications perspective, you work with investor relations. And there's a couple of things which are important to underpin a share price. The first is that your theory of how the company is going to grow, so what the underlying drivers are, is very important. So if you can convince analysts that you've got a really solid case, you know where the growth is going to come from, that's number one. The second thing is you've got to demonstrate an ability to execute on this theory that you've got. And every time you execute, you show proof that you have. So you're building momentum and people begin to trust you. But a curious thing begins to happen, which is, the more you deliver, the less rigorous people tend to be, because you've built up a track record of delivery. And that is where the gap begins to happen. And people start, to use the term bullshitting.
Mm.
And bullshitting successfully, because for the last 4 years, everything you've touched has turned into gold. So if you're not selling people a dud, they're going to buy it because they trust you.
And that's
the role of a board.
And there's so many people who had money invested in these businesses who now have very little of that left. I mean, the PIC is among the investors there. There were pension funds.
I know somebody who said they had 300K before the whole thing. Their stock was worth 300,000 rand. It was worth 60,000 rand when we spoke. By the end of that day, I don't know, it was worth. And they may issue more shares, and they might get diluted further and so on. But the point I was getting to, Gareth, is that the role of a board is to ensure that they don't get sold and buy and drink the Kool-Aid that management may start selling. Once the board begins to buy the nonsense, then you have a serious problem. And my suspicion is they were all starstruck by their wonder boy, and he started running rings around them, which happens. And I guess the point is, why didn't anybody see that this is what was going on? I think some people saw. I mean, when I was at the paper, it wasn't Steinhoff necessarily, but there was a couple of companies which I thought, they're issuing paper too much. They're either issuing more shares or, you know, raising debt or whatever, but they're expanding and they're not really making a strong case for where the growth long-term is going to come from. And what asset managers appear to do superficially is to look at the rate at which the company is expanding and they want to be part of that story. Never really examine it. So a lot more people, actually much less journalists and more the asset managers who get the opportunity of investor presentations by the company to meet company executives and ask them questions. Those guys have a heck of a lot more to answer for why they had absolutely no inkling of what was going on. When I look at Steinhoff's board, I see a problem.
I'm curious too that, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, there are criminal ramifications to this. There's certainly, Anthea was in the other day, Anthea Gardner, who does our money updates for us. And she said, well, first of all, the fact that you are lying to shareholders and that you're propping up a false set of, your reporting is just inaccurate and wrong. And if your reporting is inaccurate, that is a kind of fraud. So that already is a massive red flag.
Yeah,
I mean, he's probably going to go to jail, this guy.
I mean, we have to establish what really happened, but misrepresentation, criminal. Especially commercial misrepresentation, is fraud. And if this is what happened here, yes, it's very likely that he would go to prison. If he didn't, I think a lot of people would have, their eyes would pop out because he has admitted to wrongdoing. And the wrongdoing that appears to have happened here appears to be fraud because people have bought shares and committed commercially on the basis of what they could see, right, which was a misrepresentation. And it was a willful misrepresentation. And I cannot see how that is not fraud, at least for the one person who's admitted that they did something wrong. I don't think they can get out of it
and
now.
A lot of people saying it's for a South African context and circumstance, it's Enron size, the scandal.
It's massive, and it also brings, you know, there is a bigger issue at play here, Gareth, and that is we're at a time when the bona fides of a lot of people in positions of influence, government in particular, are in question. And for a long time, you could work on the general assumption that while there is no place that is not corrupt, you could generally trust the private sector. In other words, the price that you're being charged for whatever you're buying is the price that should be, or somewhere thereabouts, or there's a good reason for it. So there's a level of trust, even for a consumer. The fear I have is that people are going to trust nobody. And an environment where you trust no one, it is exceptionally easy to mislead people completely as a matter of course. In other words, let's look at it this way. If Bell Pottinger had arrived on the scene about a month ago, we'd be gone as a country.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Because the havoc they would have been able to wreak using this would have been profound.
Oh yeah, because this speaks into that whole white monopoly capital argument. And I see a lot of people, I mean, obviously the most vocal people here are the discredited Jimmy Manez and the like, who are using this as much as they can at the moment to try and say, well, you see, the private sector is as bad as the government. But there are a couple of differences here, so let's talk about those. Because people they always create these false equivalences. First of all, the reason that we're averse to government corruption as opposed to private sector theft is that government corruption is the public's money. It's the public's good. These are often people who are underrepresented or not represented at all, who rely on the government to make sure that things are looked after, that infrastructure is created, that schools are built, that hospitals are tended to, that kind of thing. That doesn't happen in the private sector. And if it does, and if there's theft in the private sector, it sort of self-regulates because shareholders withdraw money, the board will fire the CEO. There are direct consequences for all of this. And I think a lot of people see the two as the same. They go, oh, well, you see, this Steinhoff thing proves that the rot is everywhere. It's not just in government. Certainly there are problems in the private sector. We know about the bread cartels.
Mm.
We know about the cell phone cartels. Mm. We know about all the other nefarious things that are very widely reported in the private sector when there are bad things going on. But do you agree that that's largely market-regulated and self-regulated? And there are very strict banking, and you work in a bank now. Our banking controls are world-class. And, you know, the King Commission stuff gives us a very, very powerful position from which to judge our ability to comply with the law and to comply with basic fiduciary and legal responsibilities within companies. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I generally agree, Gareth. I think there's a couple of things, maybe three. The first is that the reason there is this conflation between public and private also has got to do with our history and our background, because, you know, an element of this conflict has got to do with the fact that a lot of people are fed up with seeing blacks being reported as corrupt and government being seen as corrupt from a sort of political loyalty point of view. And they want the other side to be seen as corrupt too, because it presents a skewed view of who really is corrupt and who isn't in society.
And of course, there's also the idea that there's a briber and a bribee.
Yeah, exactly.
And that briber's money has to come from somewhere.
Yes, yes, exactly. So there is that feeling, and it's unhelpful because all corruption is bad. So, you know, sort of celebrating that the other guy is bad too doesn't really help you in any way, because it just means you're in deeper trouble than you actually thought you were before, and should actually make you devastated. That's the first thing. The second thing, though, is that often with public money, we have no choice. In fact, all the time we have no choice but to hand it over. That's tax. Yeah,
correct.
So that's why people get worked up about it, because it's not like I have a choice. Now, if I feel a certain company is corrupt, so if I don't like Steinhoff, I simply won't buy it. Pep.
Correct.
Right?
You won't invest.
I'll withdraw my money.
Like NASPERS at the moment, a lot of people saying, well, why should be involved with this company when they're doing dodgy deals with SABC and ANN7?
Right. So you can just withhold your money, and I'm not going to consume your products. I want nothing to do with you. You can do that. With public money, you can't.
Mm.
And that's the second thing. Where the two meet, however, is also not so much the briber and bribee. It's got to do with the ethical landscape that we all sit on. Because, like I said, if you can't trust anyone, then life becomes difficult. I really have to believe that when I buy a pen at a shop, I'm being asked to pay a fair price. That I'm not being told that a pen is better quality than it actually is, and I pay more, and then I find out later. You know, there was a thing about Nurofen.
Yes.
You remember? Where
I remember that.
You could get a version for period pains.
Mm.
Now, it turns out this whole thing was hogwash. Now, that sort of thing compromises public trust in private institutions and is not a good thing.
And you can lose that trust like that, but it's very hard to build it back up.
It's very hard to build it back up. And the difference between a private company and the state, as you said, is that the market will punish you. So in the same way that a lot of people might take a decision not to buy to patronize a certain business, they can do that and do that immediately.
Yeah.
But with tax, try not paying your tax and Tom Moyane will be on your case.
Well, especially he's desperate for any kind of tax
income
right now. So who can we trust? I mean, Songeza, this goes to the heart of what so many people are frustrated by in South Africa at the moment. It always used to be that at least we knew Treasury was mostly a dependable and effective department of government. I mean, certainly you could have accused any other department of being involved in wastage and wrongful expenditure. You could have said that the minister was incompetent. You could have said this and that and the other. But when we got to Treasury, we knew these were people who were highly skilled, who were competent, who were able to deliver the goods in terms of budgeting, being able to figure out where the money needs to be spent in South Africa. And that really is the only function that anyone cares about in government, because the rest are more or less aesthetic. We know that in the case of education, a lot of it has just been absolutely wanton destruction rather than anything else. Health is questionable some of the time. You never really know whether Aaron Motsoaledi has the ear of the president and the right people, or whether he's on his own mission. But by and large, finance was one thing we could depend on. And we had very competent ministers in Nhlanhlanene, in Pravin Gordhan. And now we've got Malusi Gigaba, and some people are saying, well, give him the benefit of the doubt before we judge. But we've now had a couple of months to judge. Can we trust Treasury? Can we trust SARS with Tom Oyane?
Let me put it to you this way. There is something at play, which I'm writing about in my book. And it's not so much about Treasury specifically, but it's about what a landscape, a perceptive landscape, the last 25 years of the ANC's government has given us. So let's take out all the well-known, maybe the sort of the national scale questions aside, and let's talk about life as a domain. And you've had Dr. Manamela testifying, and you realize that this person should have never been in charge of anything at all. And now let's examine a case like that. So you have to question the motives or the suitability of the person who selected her for the role. That's the first thing. The second thing you have to ask is, so how did they use the authority they have? Did they use it in the right way? We've got a case here where that person has not used that authority. But how did they deploy public financial resources? They're likely to have misdirected public resources because they don't know what they're doing. And this is what has happened in particular over the last 10 to 12 years. You've had people who are really profoundly incapable being given very important institutions to look after when they should have never done so to begin with. And that is a challenge. You look at boards of state-owned companies, for instance. Now, you know, you need certain skills on a board and a certain level of experience, especially if the company is large, like an Eskom or a Transnet, whatever. And what we've seen, if we're honest with ourselves, is a trend where there is no regard given to the skills and experience of the people that are put on those boards. So what happens, therefore, is that the institution collapses. And so while everyone tends to be concerned about National Treasury, the Treasury has been an island in a sea of degeneration, in a very degenerative environment, and has been the reason it's had such a, one of the reasons it's had such a bad relationship with everybody else is because it controls the purse strings. So it's got a different perspective on all of this stuff over here. And it is seen as trying to tell everybody what to do. But when you're the guy who's got to hand money over and you know the guy to whom you're giving this money can't use it properly, you're going to have a problem. And that causes the tension. And so our concern should actually be much wider than Treasury or SARS.
Is this cater deployment? Because that's often what's got the ANC into this situation.
It is.
And very often, you know, I often hear people like Jimmy Money. Again, I don't want to give him too much credit, Mzwanele Money. But he says, oh no, we must look for black excellence. But then I feel that when we hear about the Dr. Manamelas of the world, it does the opposite. It almost gives fodder to real racists.
In fact, I mean,
and I think that's such a destructive thing. We can't afford to do that now in South Africa. We can't afford to be shown up to be putting people in positions that they're incapable of when we do have capable people. When we have ministers like Nhlanhlanene, whom I know you can't comment on too much because you knew the inner workings of that whole scenario as it unfolded
in that
dark December. But guys like that who are supremely ethical. I mean, from my understanding of him, and I've only spent a little bit of time in his company.
He's a solid guy,
right?
Solid
and there guy. Is an example for me of what we should be celebrating in South Africa. Instead, that's the kind of guy gets fired, and people like Faith Mutambi and Batabile Dlamini are retained as ministers. It seems to me that we want to celebrate not even mediocrity, but incompetence.
I have a position, Gareth, which I hold very dear to my heart, and that is cronyism, particularly in South African, politically driven cronyism, where it is clear that because the party in power is either the ANC or whoever might be in power in a municipality, where unsuitable people are appointed to roles, that act is anti-transformation and anti-black. Because it perpetuates every racist stereotype there has ever been about black people's ability to govern.
Correct.
Or not to govern. So
agree more.
The racist stereotype is that whenever black people are in charge of a government,
they're
going to
mess it up.
They lie, cheat, steal, and mess the whole thing up. I feel that we have a particular responsibility to use every opportunity we have to show that we are as good as anybody in the world. And this country has no shortage of good people, really great leaders, black, female, and so on.
Yeah.
No shortage. All that has happened is that it appears that those in positions of influence make very conscious decisions to choose the worst in order to advance their own ends, which usually have to do with stealing and destruction. And so we must be careful. The trick that these guys are pulling is that they are equating cronyism to transformation,
yeah,
or black nationalism, when there is nothing of the sort. And that is a fundamental lie that all of us have to fight, because lots of really fine people, it's not just Nhlanhla Nene.
In fact, whenever
there
are
a whole army of people that are sidelined because they're competent.
Well, whenever competence is brought face to face with cronyism and with people who have a hidden agenda, it doesn't suit their interest to have that competent person there.
And they often accused of being in bed with white capital.
Yeah, and
without
that person,
proving the
all
point.
That person is really doing is frustrating their attempts to steal.
Yeah.
Because they realize that that's not the way that we can make this country better. Yeah. So anybody who's good is immediately excluded on the agenda of this false transformation that you speak of, because it means that those people are the enemy.
And sadly, you know, because people get taken so easily by slogans and hashtags. In many instances where we've seen hashtag black excellence, actually it's really been a thief that people are celebrating, and later on people are disappointed. And part of the reason they're disappointed is because there is no proper consideration of whether that person is deserving of the support of all of us as somebody who may advance transformation. Look at it this way, Gareth. Anybody who has run Transnet, Eskom, SAA, should be able to run any large JSE listed company, because these are massive businesses. They make hundreds of billions a year. They've got hundreds of billions in assets, tens of thousands of employees. And so these are really large organizations. But what have we had? Can we point to anybody in the last 7 to 8 years that we can say they graduated from Transnet or from Eskom and went on to run a large company? All the people who
maybe Suzanne Zimela was one shining example when she was, I think, at some point in charge of Air Link.
Of SAA,
Then SAA.
SAA. But she's gone off and done something on her own, right? But maybe a decade ago, I mean, if you look at Thulani Gcaba, she was chief executive at Eskom, is chairman of Standard Bank, and Standard Bank is hugely successful.
Right.
So these SOCs should really be the engine that we use to transform the economy.
No, they're not. They're an embarrassment on the balance sheet. I mean, something like Eskom, this is a company that produces electricity, not just for us, but for the whole of Africa. They're the only company I can think of in the world where the service remains the same or gets worse, where the price goes up and where they tell you to use less of their product.
Yeah.
And they still don't make a profit. And they've got government bailouts. It's everything that you could throw at a problem to solve it, and it's still a problem.
Yeah.
And that's because it's being run badly.
So and that's the thing. And it's, you know, one of the things, I mean, that I learned when I was at the paper is that sometimes the people who are in these organizations are not necessarily bad themselves. They have huge stresses because they struggle to find the space to do their jobs properly, because there is somebody who's politically influential, who's putting some or other pressure on them to do one or other thing they don't want to do. This is hugely distracting. They've got to spend time in meetings. They've got to be fielding calls during the day, late into the night.
Plus, of course, in a state-owned enterprise, you've also got to balance the public and the private sector interests and your customers, who are essentially the citizens of the country. So you've got this dichotomy of being a business and of being a public service enterprise, which is a very different thing to the private business. And you've got political interests, you've got people who are trying to leverage you politically. You know, these are things that have to be considered. So you need almost better people than you would have in the private sector, in the public
sector. You do. I mean, that's absolutely true. And but the point I'm making, Gareth, is that we have really good people in the public service.
Yes.
I meet them all the time. One of the things they really battle with is keeping the politicians at bay. It takes up a lot of their time, a lot of their energy. And in many instances, some of them just eventually give up and they go and work in the private sector because they just can't do this anymore. I know people who are deeply committed to public service and really don't want to work in the public sector, not because they've got a problem with it. They really want to serve the public. They could earn a heck of a lot more. I mean, the guys in the Treasury and DTI and so on, with the qualifications they have, they really could get paid twice, three times in the private sector. But they stay in the public sector because they want to serve the country. Now, I feel particularly angry that you take somebody like that who's sacrificed an opportunity to make more money, and you then make their lives even more difficult
by forcing them to engage
by forcing them to do things that they really have no inclination of doing ordinarily. And one of the tragedies is that an impression has been created by this political interference that the public sector is full of bad people, when it's not. You've got very few, very effective and powerful actors who poison and direct power in the wrong way. And it affects the image of everybody.
Do you think that our bureaucracy is also just swollen full of people who are given sheltered employment and often in overinflated salaries as well?
I mean, you get those instances. My view is that generally the salaries in the public sector, while they're decent, they're nowhere near what we know people get paid in the private sector. And after some years' experience, let's say 15, 20 years' experience at an executive level, they still, you'll find that a director general gets paid a senior manager's salary at a private company. And so these guys are well paid, but they still lose the opportunity. The problem we have is that you have politicians in many instances insisting that incapable people get hired. And those guys, in my view, are overpaid because they shouldn't be in that role anymore. So you have this this really strange dichotomy where you've got somebody who's really capable, does a hell of a good job, and you feel they're underpaid where they are. Mm. And then you get somebody at the same level who shouldn't be there, and they are overpaid because they're not even meeting the requirements of the job. And I just feel that if we made the public sector the place you go to develop an understanding of the economy and understanding of society, international trade and so on, and you do your national service for 10 years or whatever the case is, and you know what, if in your 40s you go and work for the private sector, you create opportunities for other people to come through the ranks. Right. And you also have people in the private sector who have a very intimate understanding of how our state and policy making works, and that would help to make those relationships between the public and the private sector work a hell of a lot better, and we'd be a transformed society as well, because that's what you would get. But that's what cronyism and corruption prevent from happening. Yeah. And that's the cost that we're all incurring.
I'm very excited that your book is going to come out. You just got to get writing. So you're going to be working most of December.
Yes, I am. I am working most of December, yes.
Well, I hope you have a good holiday somewhere in between. And thank you for spending some time with us this morning. I mean, we could talk all day about all kinds of other things. I wanted to talk about the banks. I wanted to talk about the stock markets. I wanted to talk to you about cryptocurrency, whether you had a thought of that.
We couldn't do that some other time.
But I mean, I'd love to have you back in. And thank you for coming to join us this morning for what will hopefully be the first of many conversations.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Songeza Zibi. This is CliffCentral.com.